I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The Orlando Philharmonic has a new music director, Eric Jacobson, and classical music lovers are expecting big things from this conductor, who's been described as a superstar of the classical world. The orchestra's principal flute and principal clarinet are a husband and wife team who've been with the orchestra for a decade. They were also part of the search committee that recruited Jacobson. They spoke to Intersection about what's ahead for the orchestra in its first season under this new director. Exploring the talent in Central Florida, we turn now to the Orlando Philharmonic. Colleen Blagolf is principal flute. Her husband Nikolai is principal clarinet. They join us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much for having us.
The new season starts next month with a new music director, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's get to know you. So, Colleen, how did you get started playing the flute?
Just like every other band kid, basically. I started playing in the band program in fifth grade. I grew up in upstate New York. And I stuck with it, and as soon as I picked up the instrument, I knew that I loved it and that it was something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Well, you've got your flute here with you. What's your favorite piece, and could you play a little bit for us?
My favorite piece. Oh my gosh, there are so many. Thinking about the upcoming season, the music director debut, which is referred to as our Super Series 2, the closing piece on the program is Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe Suite Number 2, which has probably the most famous orchestral flute solo. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited, also very nervous about that. So I think that, for me, is probably the program to which I'm looking the most forward. Mm-hmm. So I can play a little bit of the big solo from there.
Please.
I won't play the whole thing because it's about almost 2 minutes, so... That's just the first part of it.
Beautiful.
The opening. It's a great story. It's actually the story of Daphnis and Chloe. Daphnis and Chloe, at this point in the ballet, they are miming the love story of Pan and Syrinx. Mm-hmm. And Daphnis is playing to Chloe in that scene. So the entire suite is so descriptive. It really is one of my favorites.
A lot of these ballets have kind of tragic endings, though, right?
This one doesn't.
Oh, good.
Yeah. This one does not.
Good to know. So, Nikolai, let's talk about you for a little bit. You play the clarinet, and full disclosure, I did play the clarinet when I was younger. Great instrument. Pretty hard to master, though. What is it about the clarinet that, you know, draws you to the instrument?
The reason why I started playing the clarinet is not because I really wanted to play the clarinet. It's a funny story how I actually started playing the clarinet. It's from very little, I guess. I've been drawn to music, I guess. You know, when I was little, I was drumming on buckets in our backyard. And it happened that our neighbor had a friend who used to come almost every day just to, you know, chat and, you know, talk about stuff. And it happened that he's the clarinet player of the orchestra in my town. So he heard me a few times, you know, drumming on those buckets. And he said, "Do you want to be a musician? Do you want to play the clarinet?" So this is how it happened. Basically, he introduced me to the instrument, and I started when I was 6. And ever since, I've been playing the clarinet, and I love it. I can't imagine myself playing any other instruments.
Mm-hmm. Now, for our listeners, where did you grow up? Where was your town?
I grew up in Bulgaria. A town is called Pazarjik, which is probably approximately 100 or maybe 70 miles from the capital, Sofia.
What role does the clarinet play in an orchestra?
It's one of the very important ones because it's a completely different instrument from any of the other woodwind instruments. Because it has a single reed rather than a double reed. And then the flute, I mean, you can tell the same for the flute because the flute, you know, it doesn't have any reeds at all. But it gives a little bit of a different color to the woodwinds. Softer, darker. It could play probably the softest from all the woodwinds. You can come from absolutely nowhere, even though my wife has surprised me many times. And she's always trying to match with me. So sometimes she's pretty good with coming, you know, very quietly from nowhere. Yeah.
Would you like to play something for us?
Yes, I'll definitely play. I'm doing the Copland Clarinet Concerto in about a month with the orchestra. So I'll play you a little bit of the cadenza, just a little taste. I'm not going to play the whole thing.
And this is a piece of music which classical music lovers are familiar with. It's from one of the preeminent American composers.
It was written for Benny Goodman in the 1950s. It has a lot of jazz and mostly Latin jazz elements to it. And the reason is because Copland at that time was working in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro. So he incorporated in the concerto a lot of themes that he heard from Latin jazz bands or from, you know, native music. So It has a lot of it. And some people tend to try to play it too jazzy. Some people play it too conservative. I'll probably be more towards the conservative style because the piece was basically, when Benny Goodman performed it, he pretty much stayed into, if you listen to him, he's very extremely conservative when he plays a piece. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe that you have to go too crazy.
Thank you. That was beautiful. So let's talk a little bit about the Orlando Philharmonic. I mean, they've got a new music director, Eric Jacobson. He's known for his work with Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Ensemble. He's got his own project, The Knights, which blend traditional classical music with more modern musicians like Jimi Hendrix. Nikolai, can audiences expect to hear Jacobson bring out some of that outside-of-the-box approach to Orlando?
Even in the first season, I think he's starting to... I think he's going to premiere pretty much every or at least the first two super series, I think, or the second and the third. I think he's going to bring some new music that it's actually written right now.
So it's hot off the press.
Exactly, yes. So other than that, I'm not quite sure, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be very, very, very different than what we used to.
Is this kind of an attempt to try and broaden the appeal of classical music a little bit and bring in some new audiences?
I definitely think so, yeah. Younger people, probably. With newer pieces.
Colleen, what are your thoughts on playing, you know, not just classical music? Do you enjoy playing pop music, other kinds of things?
I do, actually. Yes, I do. Interestingly enough, Nikolai and I were having a conversation a few days ago about how the pops programs that we perform are sometimes more challenging than the classical programs we do because, you know, we spend our whole lives studying the classical repertoire and trying to perfect the excerpts and things like that. And then for the pops programs, you have a ton of music and a lot of it is difficult and challenging and we don't have a lot of time to learn it. So, but I think that's one of the great things about the Orlando Philharmonic. We have this broad appeal. We perform all different genres, and we do it very well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important, especially for the future of the organization, for sure.
So, Colleen, what does it mean to have Jacobson as the Orlando Philharmonic's music director?
It's amazing. It's amazing. I can't wait until his debut. we had a little taste. We went to the Sounds of Summer concert in July, on which he performed with some of our musicians. And the vibe is just – it's tangible. It's electric. You know, you can – we're all so excited because he's just bringing just such a fresh approach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm personally very, very thrilled.
Nikolai Blagov, you were on the search committee, were you not?
Yes, we were both on the search committee. Yes.
Okay, so were you ever worried that you might miss out on landing Mr. Jacobson?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, when we started, we had over 300 and something applicants, and then I think we went down to 60, and then we went down to 12, I think, and then we went down to 5 at the end. There was a lot of talent. It was a hard work, and you know, it was just difficult to pick from so many talented musicians and conductors.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came down to the last 5, you know, we all had our favorites, and he was definitely one of my favorites, and I really wanted to make sure that he is the one.
So the Orlando Philharmonic is more than just performing on stage. You've also got some outreach. Colleen, musicians go to schools, and you've got your – do you kind of get your flute out and sort of walk students through what it's like being a classical musician?
A little bit, yeah. When we do the outreach to the schools, it's great. It's a program called Notes in Your Neighborhood, and it's a series of visits, actually, and they'll have basically one person from each instrument family visit per week.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually go to talk about the woodwinds, and I speak to them about my instrument, how I play it, things like that, basic fundamentals. And then I also talk to them about the other members of the woodwind family. And it's a great way to expose these children to something that, you know, they otherwise wouldn't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
And they love it.
What kind of things would, for example, you got your flute right here, so
yeah.
What would you be showing them?
Well, the first thing I show them is that it's in 3 parts, mm-hmm. which, you know, when I take it apart, they think, oh my gosh. But the first thing that I show them is basically how I make my sound, which is very different, obviously, from the rest of the woodwind section because I don't have a reed. So I explain that to them, and then I'll show them, you know, different techniques on the instrument, how fast the flute can play and things mm-hmm. like that, because they always get a big kick out of that.
So imagine I'm a student. What would you be showing me right now?
Well, I would first take off what the top part of the instrument called the head joint. If with every beginner, we don't give them the entire instrument. We just give them the head joint.
Right, because they got to learn how to get a sound out of it.
Exactly. They need how to produce a sound. And then just basic fingerings. Things like that.
And so when you're showing them how fast the flute can play, could you give us a little demo?
Oh, my gosh. Sure. Let's see. I would never play that fast, but
mm-hmm.
they're impressed by it anyway, so.
And I understand that members of the Philharmonic also go to the Arnold Palmer's Children's Hospital. Colleen, that must be pretty emotional at times. Is there a patient you remember or a story that really sticks with you from one of those visits?
It is emotional. It can get somewhat hard to do, heart-wrenching, I guess. But at the same time, I remember actually a lot of the patients. So there's not one specific story, I guess. But the fact that you can go in, I usually go in with Rima, our concertmaster,
mm-hmm.
and just the fact that you can go in and play, you know, one or two small, simple pieces for, let's say, a child who's hooked up to all of these machines or who's getting treatment, and just take away the worry, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and just everything kind of goes away. And the effect to see on the parents is what's really great. And also the staff, because
sure.
the staff has to, I mean, God bless them for what they do. And just to give them, you know, 5 minutes of sort of a respite from that is really, it's, I think it's one of, if not the favorite thing that I do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite piece you like to play?
We were doing Beauty and the Beast is a big hit, But yeah, I found an arrangement actually for a duet, and Rima and I, we performed that. And I remember for one child, we just kept playing that over and over and over. I think we maybe played it 3 times.
Mm-hmm. Frozen? And, is that in your repertoire?
Well, we do get requests. I'm still searching for a good duet version so that Rima and I can perform it for the kids. But it's a big hit. And actually, the child where we played Beauty and the Beast over and over again, her entire hospital room was decorated with Frozen characters and mm-hmm. posters, and Frozen was on the television. And but it was great because when we go in, you know, she was awake. But as soon as you start playing, you can see some kind of reaction, whether it's in the eyes or if they smile or if they start kicking or moving their arms. It's a really powerful, powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
So how long have you both been with the Orlando Philharmonic, Nikolai and Colleen?
I've been with the Philharmonic since 2006. Mm-hmm. I joined.
Wow.
The beginning of the season, yes.
2005.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For me.
Mm-hmm. You guys are in this for the long haul.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You must have seen some changes to the orchestra over that decade.
Yes, yes.
Well, Colleen Blagoff, principal flute for the Orlando Philharmonic, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
And Nikolai Blagoff, principal clarinet, thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. After the break, Orlando's spoken word scene is thriving. Curtis Meyer, the driving force behind the Safe Words Poetry Slam, talks about the art form. And we hear from Kissimmee's own Victor Montalvo, for the second time crowned best breakdancer in North America. Intersection returns in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Slam poetry got its start in Chicago in the 80s. Now it's an art form that can be heard all around the world. Orlando poet Curtis Meyer explains the blue-collar roots of slam poetry and what to expect from the many open mic nights in Orlando. Curtis, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, for listeners who might not be familiar with spoken word poetry, how about giving us a taste of something you wrote?
Okay, one-minute love poem. This is called Handkerchief. I've seen you go through others like tissues, disregarding them once they're through and they've served their purpose. Left piles of trash on the floor for someone else to pick up. You need something more permanent. Light to the touch, dependable like a portable pocket-sized pillow you can wash and reuse again and again. Something that won't irritate the skin or rub you raw. I want to be your handkerchief. I want to be the one that takes the sweat off your brow, gets the dirt off your hands, soak me in water and help relieve your fever. Use me as a napkin and you can wipe leftover letters from unspoken words off the corners of your mouth. I want to be the one who catches the worst of you. I want to be your handkerchief. No pretense, no metaphor, no over-the-top punchline involving hanky-panky. I want to be the threads you run your fingers across. Baptized by your spit, able to take whatever you throw at me and catch it like a circus net. I want to be your soft landing, your perfect fit, something like a tourniquet. I want your initials sewn into me. Fold me corner to corner. Place me in your drawer next to your socks and underwear, or keep me in your breast pocket so you can carry me everywhere. The one who's closest.
Thank you so much. That's awesome. Describe your process. How do you go about writing and internalizing something so that you can rattle it off like that?
I don't have everything committed to memory. That's probably the shortest one I have committed to memory. I've been doing this for, I believe it was 12 years this past June. Slams poetry specifically is a subgenre of spoken word where it's a competition with three basic rules. One, you got to come up and do something that you wrote. Parodies and homages are allowed. You can quote other people, do a little intro of someone else's quote for context, or include quotes in other people's work. I've seen people do parodies of famous rap songs, etc. But at the end of the day, the work as a whole is something that you are the sole author of. Second rule is, for poetry slam specifically, everything you present on that stage is 3 minutes with a 10 seconds grace period or below. Anything longer than that receives a time penalty, and the judging process is completely arbitrary, so don't worry about that. And the final rule is you get up and everything you do is you can sing, you can beatbox, you can stomp on the floor, you can get the audience to clap along to some real rock you type audience participation type stuff like that. But every sound, shall we say, that you produce on stage is completely you. You can't bring a harmonica out of your pocket. You can't come up in a costume because that creates bias. You can't have an instrument. And you certainly can't have props or anything to enhance a costume or anything to enhance performance like that. In terms of memorizing, that's just practice, practice, practice. After a while, if you've done your pieces enough, it just becomes muscle memory.
When people are up there, are people sometimes improvising on the spot?
There are people who get up and freestyle. It's not mandatory. It is allowed. It can go either way. But anything you can get away with in that 3-minute, 10-second time frame. A common misconception is it's like a rap battle. More likely people come up with something that they've either practiced for years, or I've seen people perform something they wrote on a napkin 10, 20 minutes earlier.
So what's your process? Do you start with the rhythm or the words? How do you get inspiration?
I personally get inspired more by concepts or news stories. A lot of people write poetry as a cathartic or therapeutic outlet, when there's nothing wrong with that. I personally like to view creativity more as almost more of a science experiment. I write a lot of what are called persona poems, persona from the Greek meaning mask, of poems in character. I go, how would this object or this person have this unique perspective? The handkerchief piece, which I performed, it's essentially just what is like the most intimate object a person can have, I guess. Like, and I just went, a handkerchief is pretty. I think I started it, there was a young lady who just used a bunch of tissues, and I was like, you need a handkerchief, and she said, no, they're stupid, and then I think I debated their merits, and it turned into this extended metaphor. It could be anything from news stories that inspire me, it could be something I read in a book, it could be occasionally something that's happened to me in my actual life. I don't vent my emotions per se, but I like to think I'm sort of cerebral, which can be a hindrance at certain times because it can be some people want to feel opposed to think.
Curtis Meyer, you're the force behind the Safe Words Poetry Slam. What's your sense of the spoken word scene here in Orlando?
I'm very proud and in awe of the bottomless pit of talent in Orlando, not just in terms of spoken word poets, MCs, musicians, beatboxers. The Fringe Festival, of course, brings in performers of all walks of life, actors, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of the spoken word scene, there really seems to be three particular groups. There's a lot that are influenced by R&B and hip-hop. There's also an older group that are sort of Kerouac-based, beat-based, page-based poetry. They write a lot of form poems. That's, I guess, more of the Winter Park crowd. And then the other group is sort of college crowd who are writing about modern topics. I've heard poems about Facebook issues, about so-and-so defriended me. I'll write this poem about it. The bevy of talent from all walks of life is absolutely awe-inspiring.
You talked before about the difference between thinking and feeling. Is spoken word poetry, poetry slam, is that a way to take poetry out of that ivory tower and bring it down to the streets?
Oh, completely. Poetry Slam, I should probably explain the origins a little bit. In 1986, this guy named Mark Smith, he was a blue-collar construction worker. He ran an open mic, and he just wanted more customers to come into the spot. The spot is the world-famous Green Mill, which was already a famous spot because in the 1950s, it was a favorite haunt of Al Capone. But Mark Smith ran this open mic, and he had this brilliant idea to go, I'll get the audience involved. And he created what was called the Uptown Poetry Slam. And it's a format that slams all across the world, including Safe Words, have adopted today. And the format is he would pick 3 to 5 judges from the audience, and they would rate the poets on their poems, performance and writing, I suppose, on a 1 to 10 with a decimal point. So like a diving competition, 10, 10, 9.5. The one kicker, though, that aggravates poets, but I always love it, is the judges aren't quote-unquote professionals. It's a completely volunteer process. And Smith's thought process was just that, to take poetry away from academia and give it back to the masses. Again, he himself was a construction worker. Probably everyone has read a sonnet or something in an anthology at some point in their life, but not a lot of people have seen poetry on stage. Not a lot of people have seen one of the best performers in the world get on stage and be in the zone for 3 minutes and absolutely captivate not only, you know, a panel of arbitrary volunteer judges, but hold the audience in the palm of their hand. The Uptown Poetry Slam in 1986, it was a stupid bar game. But there's something very romantic about this thing that this guy created just to fill time, to get customers into the bar in Chicago, now is spread around the world. I won a slam in Burlington, Ontario. There's apparently a huge scene in Australia. There's apparently a huge scene in Singapore. The World Championships is in Amsterdam. But it is something really cool that spread around the world and now in the age of the internet is slowly getting bigger.
Speaking of places where people can go to open mic, you've got your events at the Milk Bar. Where else can people catch local spoken word poets perform?
Every Tuesday at Dandelion Community Cafe. Sean Welcome hosts the Diverse Word open mic. I believe they start at 7. That is open to musicians, comedians, old performers, as well as poets. On Wednesdays, Heather Bedore hosts the Wednesday Open Words open mic at Austin's Coffee. The short version is I'd just say Google Orlando spoken word, Orlando poetry. There's more than enough to do.
Poet Curtis Meyer organizes the Safe Words Poetry Slam at the Milk Bar downtown. Curtis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
From verbal gymnastics to fancy footwork, there's also a thriving breakdancing scene in Orlando. And Kissimmee boasts North America's best. Victor Montalvo has just regained his crown as North America's reigning B-boy champion. Montalvo is from Kissimmee, and last month, in front of a hometown crowd in Orlando, he won the Red Bull BC1 North America final, which makes him the best breakdancer on the continent. Victor joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, how long have you been a breakdancer?
Well, I've been breaking for about 10 years now. My dad taught me how to break when I was like 6 years old. Just taught me backspins and a little bit of footwork. And then I just stopped for like 5 years. And my cousin got back into it from a friend. And he just taught me again. And ever since then, I've just been breaking.
So you learned the basic stuff from your dad?
Yeah.
Was he competitive as well? Did he compete?
Yeah, he told me he competed in Mexico. And he had, like, his own little crew with his brothers. Yeah, they used to, like, battle. They used to take bus rides, like 6 hours, 10 hours, like to battle in another small city. So, yeah.
Were these, like, organized competitions, or is it just kind of you there's another crew and you just try and, you know, prove who's better?
Yeah. You just try to prove who's better. You just go in there and you just try to beat them and show them you're the best.
Mm-hmm. So what's the scene like here in Kissimmee in Central Florida? Is it a big scene? Are there a lot of people getting into this?
Yeah, well, the scene back then was small, but yeah, he has been getting bigger and bigger, and I'm glad to see that.
Mm-hmm. You had a pretty big crowd too, a lot of spectators at the Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center.
Yeah, I had about 3,000, and it felt so good, like, hearing them scream my name. I was like, wow, that's crazy. My city's, like, having my back. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it felt really good.
Do people, say, you know, back in Kissimmee, are people doing this, like, on the street? Do you get kind of informal competitions going on?
Yeah, there's some competitions going on, but they're smaller. But they do it in studios at their houses.
And so breakdancing's been around since the 1980s?
No, like 1978, somewhere around there, like late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did it kind of go through a phase of where people might have just been doing it ironically to where it's now, you know, a thing that a lot of people want to do unironically?
Yeah, well, I heard there's a phase where, like around, like, the late 80s, there was a phase where they just stopped doing it. Everybody just stopped doing it, and they just, yeah, it was done, and then it came back, but, like, bigger and stronger than ever. But now it's even bigger. The whole world knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crazy to see that.
So how has it changed? I mean, for example, would a breakdancer from the 1980s recognize some of the moves that you or other B-boys are doing now?
Oh, yeah. All the moves I do, I got them from the B-boys from the 1980s. All the moves I do, all the foundation, but I just add my own flavor to it, my own, like, originality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some of it, I watched some videos from the final here in Orlando, and it's pretty acrobatic.
Yeah, it's really acrobatic. Like, for me, there's some B-boys that aren't that acrobatic. They stay with the footwork, but I'm more the explosive guy, the one that does the crazy stuff. But yeah, it's really hard. It takes a lot of work. It took me about like 6 years to get all those moves.
How do you train?
I train every day. I wake up like around 12 o'clock, start training at 3 o'clock for like 2 hours. Then I just rest. And then I start training like around 8 o'clock till 10, 11, 12.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I train a lot.
And do you have is it like, say, you know, an NFL athlete or a golfer or what have you would train? Do you have like a weight regimen or cardio,
thing? I run like 2 miles and then I start doing like little train, like workouts. And I start doing little B-boy workouts as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it hard on your joints? Like I see you've got some calluses on your hands.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You got some scars on your elbows there.
Yeah, it's really hard. That's why it's good to wear knee pads, elbow pads, because, man, I got so messed up over the years. Like, I got bruises right here.
Mm-hmm.
I got this from the competition.
What's the lifespan of a breakdance? Like, how long can you keep doing it for?
I think the lifespan is about, like, 20 years, but there's some B-boys that they don't really take care of themselves, and they just mess up their body.
Mm-hmm.
And they just can't break anymore.
What about your dad? Does he sometimes get back into it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He does, like, backspins sometimes. Like, just comes to the backyard and just out of nowhere just starts doing top rock. Then after that just starts doing backspins. Yeah, it's funny to watch.
What's the toughest routine you do?
The toughest routine is the power moves. Is the crazy air moves. I do this one move where I do a backflip. I like throw myself and I catch it. And from there, I do a flare.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's the craziest move I got.
So there's some pretty high-profile sponsorship for the competition that you just won.
And Red Bull.
So is there a future as a professional B-boy? Is that like something you can do full-time?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you could do that full time if you put yourself out there. Yeah, like you could do workshops, judging, competitions as well.
Do you do a little bit of that as well? Are you kind of being involved in the judging and so forth?
Yeah.
How about teaching younger breakdancers?
Yeah, I do that as well.
So you're off to Rome. Tell me about what's happening there.
What's happening there is the world final. So the one I did. Red Bull BC1 North America final. That one was just the national. Then I'm going to Rome to do the world final. So they're getting B-boys from the best B-boys from all over the world. So they're having all these crazy cyphers. So they're having the North America final. Then they're having the European final. Then they're having the African final. So whoever wins from all of those goes to the world final.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pick like 8 random B-boys from across the world who they think have been repping, like the best B-boys, and they put them in the world final as well. And that's when all like the top 16 best B-boys of the world battle.
So do you spend some time, you know, watching videos of your rivals to see what they're doing?
Nah, I don't really worry about them. It's better to worry about yourself.
And what about the difference between, say, you know, what you and your fellow B-boys are doing here in North America compared to what you might see in France or, you know, from some of the African countries where they do this too?
Well, what do I think is different from me?
Yeah, is there a different style wherever you go in the world?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of b-boys that just have, it depends on the b-boy, but yeah, they kind of do have a different style in each country. Mm-hmm. Like in France is more explosive, more blow-ups, more crazy moves, but they don't really have the foundation of it, the dancing part. Some do, but over there is more explosive. Africa as well too.
Mm-hmm.
But America, there's a lot more foundation. Like the b-boys have a lot more dancing in it, foundation. Mm-hmm. You know.
And is there any crossover between, you know, what you do, what b-boys do, and say other things like parkour, you know, free running? Is there kind of an overlap there at all?
To me, skateboarding is like the closest thing to b-boying, because it's just so similar.
Well, Victor Montalvo, North America's reigning b-boy champion, best of luck to you in Italy.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, local band BMO is steeped in the folk traditions of Americana, but they have eclectic roots and they have been known to cover Ozzy Osbourne. BMO are in the studio after the break. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. The song you're hearing now is Rip Van Winkle, and the band is BMO. Vocalist Dan Harshbarger, guitarist Sean Quinn, Matt Giuliano on mandolin, Tony Mickle on bass, and Justin Braun percussion. BMO describe themselves as an indie acoustic band with mountain roots. Later this month, they're releasing an EP. Four-fifths of the band work for the same company, which is how guitarist Sean Quinn and vocalist Dan Harshbarger first met. So you guys go back a ways. When did you form?
I met Dan a long time ago. We met at a club watching a band together. We realized we worked at the same job, and that's where we recognized each other. So anyway, we had different genres of music. We came together, came to this kind of pop rock-ish. How would you explain that, Dan?
Yeah, we were kind of like a power pop sort of band for a couple of years, and then stepped back from that for a while. And then missed playing with each other, and we ended up recording at your place for a while. And then once really Matt joined the mix, things started to gel some more. But we didn't get back into the power pop thing. We moved more toward the acoustic thing. It was easier to record, and we just kind of enjoyed the sound that was coming from that. And then from there, it kind of evolved.
Right, yep. Brought in Matt, and then we brought in Tony, and most recently we brought in Justin. We realized we were missing percussion, so that was kind of completed us.
So you've gone from power pop to Americana. You've gone back in time in some ways, right?
Yeah. But I think the more we got into an acoustic feel and the tone of how I sing and really just how we wrote the songs, it kind of transcended the genre that we were doing before. We were able to basically reconstruct the songs, the arrangements, but the melodies and the hooks were still there, and the instrumentation just gave it new life.
I read that you included Johnny Cash, Ray LaMontagne among your influences, and what you say is the classic Athens, Georgia sound made popular by REM. Let me ask you this question, Matt. How do you define that Athens, Georgia REM sound? Is it the mandolin?
That definitely is part of it. One of my big influences, too, in addition to those, is kind of the Newgrass, Nickel Creek sort of thing. That was one of our things. It's hard to peg into rock or folk or bluegrass. It's sort of a mix. It's the confluence of all of those together. And so it can be a little hard to put your finger on, but mm-hmm. you can hear it from the instrumentation and some of the arrangements.
So you're playing on classic Americana instruments, but you might be playing a new genre of music?
Right. And some of our, you know, when we play live, we'll throw a couple of covers in, and we usually pick them from very diverse influences. We played Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne at Tin Roof, so...
Crazy Train on the mandolin is perfect.
Does that give you some room to shine, Justin, as a percussionist?
It does, because their songs are so well constructed and so polished that I can just fit into the spaces that they create and not even have to worry to hold the group together. They're already together. I just have to play along, really.
So, Tony, what's the audience like for the style of music you guys play?
It's very diverse. So we'll play a festival, and there'll be kids in the audience, there'll be teenagers in the audience, there'll be families. But then we'll turn around and play the social. You know, that's another kind of diverse crowd of a lot of our friends, a lot of people that make that scene. Most recently, we've played at the Imperial. That is a whole nother type of scene because it's a little more mellow. It's not a big place. It's kind of small. So we basically, we can either play these really large venues or these really small venues, and we can adjust the music accordingly.
Dan, what about out of state? Do you guys have a bit of a reputation outside of Florida as well?
I'd say mainly right now the falling outs out of the side of the state is probably family and friends. We primarily kept our playing pretty much to Orlando, Central Florida area. We're planning, though, for like, the fall to start branching out to Tampa and Melbourne.
We actually went up to Savannah for something for Matt, and we had a really good vibe when we were there. We actually got to write a song while we were there because we were all together. We brought our instruments. That's the kind of folks we are. So I really liked Savannah. I thought that was neat, and I like the way Georgia just sort of has a cool feel to it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of on our radar, so to speak.
Is Florida getting some of that vibe as well?
I think so. I know there's so many really good festivals. I think it's just a matter of tapping into them. I mean, we're still relatively young when it comes to the age of the band. So we're just, we try to make sure we pick the right festivals, the right audience, and it's critical when we're trying to branch out like that.
So, Sean, you guys have day jobs too?
Yes, we do.
How much time do you have for music?
It is a challenge. The work-life balance is definitely a challenge, but this is playing music is our release. We get to hang out with our best friends here. We get to work together, not necessarily directly together, but it does provide us a release. You get to hang out with your friends, and we're creating music, and we're doing what we love. So it, and then you got to have your families to back you, because it does take a lot of time out your free time, going practicing, traveling to gigs, going to the studio, doing things of that nature.
What are you all working on now? You've got an album in the pipeline?
We do. We are working on our third EP. The first two EPs were the four of us, and that's, we really needed percussion with these songs. That's where we brought Justin in, and it's been such a huge addition. We are finishing up, actually. Dan just laid down some vocals.
Yep.
We will start the mixdown process, mastering, be done in the next couple of weeks, and we're going to have a CD release on the 25th of September.
So you're the newest member of the band. Justin, are there more people going to add to this ensemble, do you think, or is this it?
It really depends on where we're playing and when we're playing. I'm sure for the type of show, if it's a big festival gig, I don't know, I'd be open to adding some auxiliary players. But I don't know, I'm not the right person to ask about that.
Who makes the decisions?
I think what's pretty cool about the group is we all have different strengths in that regard, that we typically make team decisions, which is good. Depending upon the moment, depending upon the time or the type of decision to be made, whether it's musical or how we're trying to push and market things, different players bring different strengths to it, and we all kind of come to a collective agreement. I mean, we'd like to see this music be pushed out as far as it can, but I think we also value our friendship and respect each other quite well to where we value each other's inputs.
Decisions are pretty much made over the group text message.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going off like every 10
Can I get
minutes.
A yes or can I get a no? It's kind of how we pose it.
We abandoned the trial by combat model. They heal up before shows, so.
Have you been on tour yet?
No.
Any plans for that?
Yes.
Yes. Definitely a yes. That's why we're actually just trying to see which venues would be the best for us, and because of the cost, the time, and all, and basically, you know, the time away from our family too. So we've got to make sure it's worth it. And right now, we just haven't decided if it's all in the cards right now.
Is that something that you think, could this be good for the band in terms of, you know, you guys are all friends now? If you go on a long tour, what happens at the end of that tour?
that's certainly that is an excellent question. Don't know.
Yeah, we've never really traveled together very far from our home base, really. But I don't know. It's kind of hard to plan a tour when we're all working like full-time jobs and have families and things like that. I'm the only one who can pretty much go up and go. But the work-life balance, as you said, gets harder as you get older.
So where can people hear BMO if they want to catch you guys live?
So we've got a pretty busy September. The first show is going to be at the Imperial, right? That's the very first
actually,
one.
Actually, Winter Garden, September 4th.
Oh, wow, will
be
that's
at
right.
Attic Door. It's a wine bar down there on Plant Street. And then night after that, on the 5th, we'll be at the UCF Art Gallery for a Guitars in the Gallery event. And then moving on to the Imperial downtown on the 16th, Wednesday night, for the Imperial's acoustic soundcheck. And then big event on September 25th, we will be releasing this new EP that we're pretty excited about at the Orlando Brewing Company.
BMO, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you so much for having us.
And is there another song you'd like to play us out on?
What do you want to do?
See, Full Out Couch.
Okay, so you want to explain it?
Yeah, this is the title track off of our second EP. It's about meeting someone and not knowing if you're ever going to see them again and just kind of daydreaming about them. And this is kind of the result of that, I suppose. So this is called Fold Out Couch.
Quiet on this fold-out couch, I wonder if I'll ever see her again. She's all she made me stun, she bribed me down to earth, and then she knocked me right back up again. I've had the most wonderful day, everything is going my way, cause I love her, but I don't even know where I can see her. Only remember just to smile and I need her. This fold out couch, and I'm wondering if she's thinking the same. I love the same another day, but my pain is gone, and I don't know if she's headed my way. I'm so glad I can finally say everything is going my way, cause I love her, but I don't even know where I can see her. Only remember just to smile, and I need her. Spend the rest of my life with her just 5 minutes. For the intoxication to take hold. Cause I love her, but I don't even know where I can see her.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Join us on Friday morning at 9 for the weekly news roundup. We'll be taking your calls. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.